We are now on paper 15, jumping around. Takashi.
Okay, the next issue, Journal Paper 15, discusses measurement of long-term interest that form part of the net investment in associates and joint venture. Those interests that we refer to as long-term interest in the paper. The committee discussed this issue last year, but did not reach consensus. At its meeting in November, the committee decided to refer the issue to the board, particularly questioning whether IFRS 9, including its impairment requirements, applies to long-term interest, and if so, how the requirements in IAS 28 and IFRS 9 interact. The board discussed this issue in December and February and agreed with the staff analysis as summarized in paragraph 33 of the paper. Our analysis of the issue is included in paragraphs 16 to 31 of the paper, which is essentially the same analysis that we discussed with the board in February. We also assess the issue against the committee's agenda criteria in paragraph 32 of the paper. Even though there are differing views with respect to this issue, we think that the requirements in IFRS standards provide an adequate basis to enable an entity to determine how to account for such long-term interest. Consequently, we recommend that the committee should not add the issue to its agenda. The proposed wording for the tentative agenda decision is provided in Appendix A to this paper. Questions 1 and 2 ask whether you agree with the analysis and recommendation, and if you do, whether you have any comments on the proposed wording of the tentative agenda decision.
If I may, I'd like to put the question slightly differently based on our conversations yesterday. I'd like the first question to be, do you accept the staff's analysis? Second question is, how do we best communicate that analysis? So let's focus first on, do you accept the staff's analysis of how you apply the standards? Tony, you're reaching for a button?
Yeah, I do. I agree that this is the way I would have looked at the interaction of the standards, and I think it's probably consistent with what I said at the last meeting. So I'm comfortable with the analysis. I think we can obviously talk about how we best communicate it next. I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to say there's a couple of things that I think, whether it's an agenda decision or some other mechanism, we might need to think about addressing. And in particular, how if you go through step one, you do the IFRS 9 impairment test, you then move on to test the net investment, you get an impairment in the second test, how do you allocate that impairment? What are the implications of doing that for testing under IFRS 9 next year? So do you actually reduce the balance subject to IFRS 9 as a result of the impairment? How does that then interact with the effective interest method? So I think there's some mechanical questions that we ought to explain. So I will pause there. Happy with the analysis, couple of mechanical questions, and come back to how we communicate it.
Bob?
I was going to say same as Tony. I think the analysis is correct. I support it. I also had questions on the mechanics.
Mikhail?
I had hoped that we would come to a conclusion of IAS 28, but when you have the arguments about that it's not part of the equity method because it's only due to that it takes part of the losses, I would say that is the same for the shares, so to speak. I don't see how that is an argument for saying that it's not according to the equity method, that you have no OCI effects, etc. I mean, that will not be on the shares either. So I don't see that argument for that conclusion. And then secondly, maybe it's a mechanical thing, but if you apply the 33B there, having first the impairment of IFRS 9, and then you go over to have the normal equity accounting then and say that we have loss making And then, I mean, in my mind, we will start having the loss making from the shares, and then you going over to the long-term interest. Then you already have made an impairment valuation of this instrument. And then you put less value, so to speak, reduce the value even more with the losses. That, I think, is unlogical, in my mind, at least double accounting, so to speak.
Okay, John.
I mean, I agree. It's one view of the requirement for SAMR, but I don't think that's the only view. I think that the support for all four views, which are previously discussed by this committee, I'm not even sure that it's the best view. And I think about the interaction between the impairment requirements of IFRS 9 and then the actual impairment requirements in IAS 28. There's also questions about the allocation of losses under IAS 28 and how that then plays back into IFRS 9 in terms of impairment. It's also a question about how I apply an expected credit loss model to the interest in which settlement is neither foreseeable nor planned in the future. In other words, there's no expectation of timing of cash flows for these long-term interests. Or there doesn't have to be. So how does an IFRS 9 expected credit loss model work? So, you know, while I accept that that could be one view, I think there's a lot of mechanical and conceptual questions about how they work together. So I'm not sure it's the best view. I certainly don't think under current standards it's the only view.
Carl?
I think it's possible to achieve staff's conclusion. However, I think it was very, very heavily elaborated to achieve this conclusion. I think it would be helpful to get some clarity, additional clarity in the wording. Let's discuss the format of this communication.
Bruce?
Thanks. I just wanted to echo. I mean, I actually support what John was saying. I mean, I think that the staff's view is great, but you could have brought the argument the other way as well. So I do think it's an issue of the diversity, but I think to turn around and say I think that it's clear that that's the only way it should be applied, I think it's a bit of a stretch.
Bonnie?
A lot of similar comments to those that are questioning whether or not this is the only approach and the right approach. I guess as I was reading through the paper, I thought it would be extremely helpful to have an example, maybe a couple of examples, because as I was kind of working through the steps, kind of in paragraph 23, maybe one thing that was apparent to me is, does it make sense that you would only pick up your equity percent of the gains, but then you pick up more than your share of the losses potentially, because you're allocating the losses not only to your actual equity interest, but then also to the long-term interest, which seems like equity on one side, then doesn't seem like equity. And then as I was looking at paragraph 28, is this the specific order that you would go? And I had some of the questions that the others had about how do you allocate the pieces of the loss. I think we need to have an example and maybe a couple of examples to show kind of the variance of what are the different situations that there might be to which this situation would apply. And B, I think we need to come back and talk about it a little bit more, because I think there's some variance in what actually is the right answer. So I don't think what's in the guidance is clear.
There's just one, if I can clarify, there's just one point that I know has come up a couple of times, and it's only to refer into that in paragraph 29 in the paper, at least we do try to add on and clarify in our view how the interaction would work. You know, that if you do end up going through what is kind of steps B and C in paragraph 28 and either allocating losses to the long-term interests or taking some impairment, at least we do try to clarify in there, at least our view that would say that that's something that would need to be kept separate when you then continue your sort of IFRS 9 measurement on the long-term interest going forward. So I know that doesn't answer every question raised, but I just thought I'd highlight that as...
But that's not in the agenda decision.
It's not an agenda decision at the moment. It certainly could be in there, but it's not at the moment.
Philippe, you wanted to come in?
Yes, it's a follow-up to Bonnie's point. I like the committee to carefully consider the point that Bonnie made, either the mechanics or the debits and credits of this proposal do not result in picking up twice the losses. because I expressed this point at the board table when we had the discussion. I've not been convinced yet that the answer I got are totally convincing to me. Let's assume you have an affiliate which is loss-making and you have this long-term investment. You determine that it is fully unrecoverable. So write it off totally or take a 100% expected loss provision. Doesn't it in effect result in implicitly the affiliate recognizing a profit for no longer having to repay this loan, hence reducing the amount of losses that you have to pick up through the equity accounting? Otherwise, you seem to be missing an element. I know legally the loss is not forgiven, so the loan is still there, it's not forgiven, so it's still a liability in the associate's book. But the fact that everyone has determined this will not be repaid could be seen as creating a profit in the books of the affiliate for the non-repayment of this liability. So in considering how much of losses you have to pick up through your equity interest, isn't that something that you should think of? So I like this point to be explored in terms of the debits and credits of the mechanics in order not to have to pick up first the losses on the long-term interest and then again the losses on the affiliate's equity.
I mean, I'll give the same response that I did at the board table, but I just want to put parameters on what we're talking about. and if everybody here says they want it done, clearly we will do what we're told to do and absolutely do it. But it's only to say that, just to remind that I don't get me wrong, I think that we can do all of this and we can work all of the mechanics. It's just that specific point that you raised, Philippe, and about, you know, some of that, you know, both sides of the entries and double counting and stuff. I think it's essentially asking us to work up and work through the process that is the equity method. Now, we can do that, but that seems quite beyond the submission and the question asked, and it's going much broader into whether we think the way the equity method works makes sense or not. So I suppose I just caution and say, look, we've tried to analyze and pick up. I understand why people say they think it's not possibly the only interpretation of the words there, but when you work through the process, there's just a lot of interaction between with how the, you know, how equity method accounting works, which seems to go way beyond the question asked.
I'm only asking the staff to submit to the committee the outcome of applying what is proposed in the agenda decision. How does that work, and is there any problem with that outcome?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah, no, and fine, I'm sorry, that's certainly...
Sandy, you're wanting to come in?
Yeah, I guess I feel like when I read this that we hadn't even had the conversation that we had last time. Because I guess the comment there that it's about the discussion of the how the equity method works, I don't necessarily agree with that. And the conversation about mechanics, I couldn't hear all of what Philippe said. But when we work through the mechanics, we're going to see that we produce a nonsensical result. I guess, to me, you've got the instruments that you account for under IFRS 9, and you've got the items that you account for under the equity method. And then we're taking these instruments that we're calling long-term investments, or long-term instruments, and we're somehow saying the tenor of the investment changes how we account for the impairment of it. Because I don't actually know what a long-term investment is. That's a management intent-based thing. It doesn't change the cash flow characteristics of the instrument to me. So I thought we said in the last meeting, particularly the illustration where the item was already accounted for at fair value and we were going to take another adjustment to it, illustrated that it actually produces a nonsensical result. And I don't really get the point about this is how the equity method works. I get that this is how this paragraph in IAS 28 says, well, if you have some additional losses, allocate them. But is that really how the equity method works, or just how this particular paragraph says that things should work? Because we're going to get to mechanics that show, particularly if the items are already under the long-term investments are already at fair value, or even if you have the disclosed fair value of these items, you're going to see that I'm going to reduce the fair value by an impairment that I may not bear. It's like the fair value is wrong. So I guess I'm struggling with, I get that that's what this paragraph says, but what I don't understand is if this paragraph really makes any sense. And the mechanics are going to show that the theory doesn't make any sense, particularly, in my mind, if it's already carried at fair value. I'm just struggling a little bit in, after I go through all these machinations, it's going to come up with some numbers that don't mean anything.
Correct. Question to the staff. If I understand the operation of none, and the requirements to meet a long-term investment, I don't know how you can have it at fair value.
I would expect it to be.
I would think it highly unlikely that you could meet the criteria for carrying that item at fair value and meet the criteria for it being a long-term investment. I think it would have. I think if it's a long-term investment, I would expect it would be at amortized cost.
I think that's what it would be, yep, most of the time.
So, and I agree, Sandy, if it were at fair value, you'd have a funny answer, but it ain't going to happen.
Right, but a good user of financial statements is going to go look over to the other column and say, well, yeah, maybe I can't carry this at fair value. But there's the disclosure of fair value, and you might actually have a number that's lower than the fair value because you took this impairment. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Because you took the impairment or because you took your share of the loss?
Because I took the share of the loss from this operation of the application of the equity method. I hear what you're saying about long-term investment, but, you know, the reality of it is you don't, that's an accounting convention that we say that it's a long-term investment. Management can change its mind tomorrow. So investors look at the financial statements and say, well, yeah, that's what they say it's worth, but this is what it's really worth because I got to go in and out of the transaction, the company today, so I want to know what the value of the investment is today. So you're going to, I get that you may not carried at fair value, though that was discussed, if memory serves me correctly, in the last paper, the last meeting's paper. But you're still going to be taking that allocation of losses to this investment, and if it's a big number, somebody's going to look over at that fair value and go, what's that all about? I don't get what you're doing there.
Yeah, I take your point. The only place at which I would disagree. I don't think the characterization of something as a long-term investment is a management decision in the company in which the investment is held. It's a decision based on the characteristics of the instrument. So I don't think it's a management intention-driven judgment, at least not the management of the reporting entity in which the investment is held. Philippe?
It might be that this...
Sorry, we're cutting each other off.
It might be that this long-term interest is structured in a way where it doesn't meet, it fails the SPPI test. Hence, it has to be at fair value P&L. That's one case where you could have a fair value accounting for that. Because if we say that all requirements in IFRS 9 apply, it includes the classification and the assessment of cash flows, and then the SPPI test applies, and you may fail the test. So you may have one in such. Well, if this long-term interest is leveraged in terms of remuneration, if it has a component of participation in results, all that makes it fail the SPPI test.
Then just to say, I think that does go beyond the main question then, though, because if you're a fair value through P&L, you're not going to be applying impairment testing in 9, whereas the question was much more about, do I have to apply the impairment requirements in 9? I think the other thing to clarify, by the way, and don't get me wrong, I know that we're sort of looking at the steps we've outlined as the process, but I do think that the the number of times that, given if you've applied an expected credit loss model in IFRS 9 to the long-term interest, and then if there are any losses, you've come along and allocated losses, the number of occasions I think you'd end up actively recognising any further impairment when you apply IAS 28, I would expect to be quite rare.
Can't go beyond zero.
Yeah, exactly.
Andrew?
Thanks.
I'm sorry, I apologise. I was on the phones and I didn't go to Fei Long. I don't care, so. Fei Long, are you?
I don't have comments on the analysis, but I do have a comment on the accounting for long-term interest. The staff indicates that the entity would account for long-term interest at paragraph 20A. The C, entity will assess the net investment for impairment applying the requirement in paragraph 40 and 41A to 43 of IAS 28. It should be applied cautiously. In practice, certain entities assess payment on investment in associates using fair value, less cost of disposal. The fair value is usually determined on the active shares, excluding the long-term investment loan. Entity A holds 40% equity interest in an associate, plus advance currency unit 10 million to the associate loan in long-term investment loan. Given that the loan is recorded in the associate book as a liability, the fair value of 40% equity interest would have taken into consideration the associate obligation to repay the loan and hence lower. If the currency unit 10 million was part of the capital contribution to the associate, the fair value of 40% equity interest will be higher as the associate has no loan obligation. So we probably need to be use this cautiously.
Okay. Andrew, Young-Soo, and then we'll cycle back to Tony.
Thanks. Just a few brief points. On the question of how do these loans get to be classified as long-term interest in the first place, from what I've seen in practice, there is a healthy or unhealthy measure of management intent
okay. In
that classification, I would have to say. On the economics double counting or time and a half counting, whatever it might be, I tend to agree with Trina that I think is a challenge for whether or not you should be accounting for loans under IAS 28 at all. So that's possibly better addressed as part of the broader research project. I think wherever you get to on the IFRS 9 impairments scope question, you could still face that challenge of whether, as a result of allocating losses, we could end up sort of writing down a receivable that actually we're going to recover some of.
Yeah.
Be my take on that. Yeah. On this basic question, I think that where the staff have got to it would be my kind of more natural reading of the literature here, but like the other more recent speakers, it wouldn't be the only way I could interpret the standards. In particular, if I had to highlight one thing, I think it's that the IFRS 9 scoping paragraph and then how that scope is described in IAS 28, you know, they say different things. So difficult to say this is the only way to interpret the standard when we have what seems to be fairly clear inconsistency between the two standards.
Okay. Young-Soo, then Tony, then Reinhardt.
I agree with Andy that, you know, if we strictly applying the standards, we cannot but get to the same conclusion as the staff. So that, you know, I agree with the staff analysis and conclusion. I have no objection to that. But applying both the standard IFRS 9 and the IAS 28 create double counting of impairment or not. To me, it's double counting. you know, the IFRS 9, what we do is to apply the expected credit loss model, which means that, you know, we first predict the future cash flows and divide it by the initial, the interest rate. So that to me, the future credit, I mean, future cash flow already reflects all the losses made by the subordinate. It already reflects it. But we count the additional losses from the associate. It seems to me double counting. So that, you know, what I'm trying to say is that I agree with the staff. You know, if we, you know, what we have to do is just directly follow the standard. But is it right or wrong? As Andy said, we are doing the equity method projects. We have to wait for that maybe. But we have to think about whether it is double count or not for the impairment.
Tony?
Yeah, I just wanted to come in and say something. I think it's largely being said already. But yes, I think you can have one of these at fair value if it fails solely payments of principal and interest. Yes, I think there is management intent. The standard says when you get into one of these long-term things, it says for which repayment is neither planned nor likely. But the point that I guess I wanted to make is that I'm just becoming a bit nervous about scope creep, in that we've been asked a question about impairment, and we've had a lot of discussion about the loss allocation method in IAS 28. I don't think we've been asked about that. Yeah. And while none of us like it, and personally I don't like the equity method at all, I think we ought to... that's not the subject here. That's the subject for the board's research project. So I really think we ought to restrict what we're talking about to the question we were asked.
And to be fair, I think that was the boundary we tried to put around the board, which is say, please tell us how you think the word should be read before you start making any comments about what you think.
Yeah.
And I think a number of board members include Philippe, and I'm not going to disagree with anybody that says I'm not sure whether this is the, you know, the best answer, but we try to say, okay, our job at the moment is to say what do we think the words, you know, the words say, and a separate question is whether we think we want the standard changed to do something.
So on
different.
The question of how you do impairment. So staff, you accept the staff analysis or
yeah, that's what I said way back at the beginning.
Well, I've got a scorecard going. Reinhardt, last call.
Yeah, just very briefly, I mean, consistent with comments a number of others have made, I think based on a technical analysis of the scope intersection between IAS 28 and IFRS 9, I think that the staff analysis is correct. But I think as others have said, it's like the proverbial American expression, it's like the dog that caught the car, what do you do next? Because as others have said, I'm not entirely convinced that in order to, because these long-term interests are quasi-equity and the board acknowledges in effect that they're quasi-equity in the basis of conclusions, that you can marry the IFRS 9 principles very readily. Questions about how do you do the expected loss calculations or determinations, questions about the classification of that interest, because I'm not convinced where there's no plan to repay in the foreseeable future that's in a business model that's held to collect and therefore meets the SPPI criteria. Mm-hmm. So I think those issues probably need to be fleshed out some more, which really points to, in my mind, that these long-term interests are not what we would normally think of as being IFRS 9 type liabilities because they're quasi-equity. And so I think it's important to explore that because those issues do come about. I think we presumed amortized cost for the long-term interest, and as others have said, if that's the way the analysis proceeds, we need to make some included whatever guidance we issue how you treat that additional impairment under IAS 28 for purposes of IFRS 9 amortized cost. But as I say, I'm not entirely convinced we even get to amortized costs necessarily because of the interplay between what meets the definition of a long-term interest under IAS 28 and the IFRS 9 classification criteria.
You're saying you can't say it's for collection of principal and interest if you don't expect to ever get any?
That's the question I...
Bingo. Yes.
Thank you, Sandy. I...
You said it much better than I did, but I wholeheartedly agree with what Reinhardt just said, because what it's telling you is that you have mischaracterized the classification of that asset from the beginning, or at least right now, but from the beginning, because you're presuming the application of the equity method that you can allocate these losses to this instrument when in fact the credit structure may not be that you can actually do that.
Can I just clarify though, Reinhardt? Sorry.
Please go ahead.
Can I just clarify, Reinhardt, though, is that you are thinking, though, that, or tell me if I'm wrong, is that there is a notion of long-term interest, though, that are you don't apply the equity method to, and therefore you must apply IFRS 9 to?
That is a technical, I think I would agree with that, because there's no other way, nowhere else to look to,
yeah,
other than IFRS 9, but it just raises all kinds of IFRS 9 type questions in terms of classification, if it's amortized cost or not, if so, expected loss calculations, et cetera.
But isn't that, just to clarify then, doesn't that go quite a bit beyond what the question asked was, in a sense, which seems to go into, and tell me if I'm wrong, suggesting going into, well, what are the things that get classified as long-term interests and how would they be classified under IFRS 9? And
okay, Philippe and Bonnie, and then we're going to quit. Philippe?
That will be my last comment in relation to what Tony said about scope creep. Maybe the agenda decision should only address the first point. Do you apply IFRS 9 for impairment, full stop? And do not try to explain then how you do the loss allocation model, etc., because this is where we seem to have some difficulties in applying the model in terms of equity accounting. You just explain that IFRS 9 does apply, and then that's it.
Bonnie?
I think if we were to do that, it seems like it's not incredibly helpful. So I think to maybe Reinhardt's point and to answer Petrina's question is, I think it's fundamental to understand what the model is to apply to the long-term interests. Is it an IFRS 9? And if so, there's a lot of application questions of how do you apply the impairment model. And if it's not, then is it equity accounted for, and that I think answers the question. So I think there are some other fundamental things that need to be addressed before we can come to a conclusion that is in any way helpful in answering the question. That's my view.
Okay. With regard to the question of whether people agree with the staff analysis, there is not sufficient support to go ahead with anything. There are too many no's. Many of them said, well, yeah, it's one, but there are two or three. There were four views presented in the original analysis, and I think some people would say I could buy any one of them. I'm not being pejorative in that. I'm just saying those all four seem to be reasonable ways through the literature. I am concerned, though, that like many issues, and somebody said, we seem to be forgetting what we talked about last time. And maybe we need to be more straightforward in the paper to say, okay, these are the set of things that we laid out. For example, we said that we thought it was a financial instrument within the scope of 9. We did not expect, I think, that it would be at fair value. I'm talking to Petrina here, but only because I can see her and I can't see.
Well, the original submission said, assume that it is the financial assets that are measured at amortized cost.
I understand that. And we took that at face value. Pardon the pun.
I don't think it changes my view in things, though.
Oh, I understand. But we do not, as I count the votes, have enough support to proceed with the staff view in any circumstance.
I don't know about that. I think, but I don't know. I don't want to put words in anybody's mouth. Of course, I did think that you're right to say that probably we don't have enough to say everybody thinks that the existing requirements in IFRS get you only to what the staff's suggesting.
I think that's what I just said.
Yeah, sorry. What I didn't know was whether we might have enough to say either via another route, via interpretation or something else.
Okay.
The
question then for the group, and we're already over time, but we recognize that problem with today. Is this the best route through to say that it belongs to IFRS 9 for impairment, and then it belongs to 28 if there's any left, essentially? Bob?
I think there may be a potential way to move forward on this through an amendment. I know it's not fully agreed here, but my personal belief is that it is in the staff analysis is absolutely correct that it's in 9 and 28, and you have to apply both. We could potentially go down an amendment to take it out of one. Now, I recognize the scope creep issues and concern, can we do it such that we don't get into other issues, but that I think that's a potential way forward.
I was giving thumbs up to the IT department, not to you.
So Bob, just to understand, I think what you're suggesting is that we could potentially, your suggestion on an amendment would be to decide either these long-term interests are in 28 or an IFRS 9.
Right, because I'm in agreement with everybody, a lot of people here, I don't think it's best to have them in both. I just think that's what if you were going to do an agenda decision, that's what the literature tells me.
Yeah. Which is what the board agreed with.
So your idea of an amendment then, would it be to take them out of 28 for anything or just for impairment?
Well, I think that can be discussed. We could take it out of, one of the views was to take it out of 9 for impairment, but leave it there for classification and measurement. I'm not saying that's we have to go. There's different ways we can go.
Only to express the views that at least some board members expressed in February, and board members at the table can correct me. I think that there would be at least some quite strong pushback at the board level to suggesting that these would come out of 9.
Okay, then none of you take it out of 28.
Probably, at least there was less strongly held views possibly about the other way, although we didn't allow the board to contemplate that.
John?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we could look at progressing something by an amendment. I mean, I do think there's diversity in practice. I do think the standards are unclear and do support maybe not all four views, but at least two there I would be comfortable with. But I think there's a lot of issues to address in determining how to move forward. I mean, there's also the issue of IAS 21. I mean, IAS 21 considers these part of the net investment in a foreign operation, and therefore they're translated using IAS 21. That's not IAS 39 or IFRS 9 accounting for the item either. So there's a whole lot of there's a whole lot of disconnects between treating these within IAS 28, but then saying actually they're really fully in IFRS 9 and all you do is allocate losses. I mean, there's also other issues that have to be considered. So I don't think it's a short, easy fix.
Yes.
Unless you're going to take it fully out of one or fully out of the other. To try and reconcile the two and have it in both is going to be quite an exercise, I would expect.
Carl?
I'm also in favor of some kind of amendment to bring more clarity.
Over in the regulator corner?
Because Bob and others have brought it up, one of the things that we considered, obviously we have the same observations as people around the table about the math, how do you allocate losses, if you do have an how do you allocate the impairment, and how do you move forward from there? But if you were to consider an amendment, one observation we had was if you went into 28 and you changed the word net investment in paragraphs 40 through 42 to carrying amount for all but one of them, you could just leave it as investment, that might solve the double impairment conundrum we seem to be in.
Just to understand, would you effectively be saying by changing that then don't have the long-term investments subject to the impairment?
So long-term investments would be subject to impairment under 28. However, you would have the same scenario where you'd pick up losses if management's intent was what it needed to be, I think, to continue to support.
Yes, I'm sorry. So what you'd say is you'd leave the long-term losses as part of the allocation of losses. So when you allocate losses to the long-term investment,
circumstances are such that you have an intent to continue to fund the organization. Yeah.
But do not subject the long-term interest to the
impairment
20.
Under 28. Those would be that would be subject to impairment under 9 only. But then I also see a benefit to looking to the definition of what is a long-term investment, because it doesn't really fit into 9 because of the nature of it, that it's not going to be collected. It's not just principal and interest. Then maybe it should be only in 28. and not at 9. But I know, I haven't really solved your problem, just giving you two alternatives.
Okay. What I think I'm hearing, subject to somebody screaming at me, is that we ought to do something. That having this amount of diversity, especially at the table, is not useful. That implies we're going to have to pick one. What I propose is that the staff take back the approach that they have outlined here. Show us what it would look like as an amendment rather than an agenda decision. What would we have to do to the existing standards to make this work? I think you have quite a shopping list of other concerns that have been raised. I think that we have to articulate all of those other concerns and either say what we plan to do about them or say we can't go there. But I think we do have to, I think several people have said, well, what about this, what about that? I think we have to go through that process. Does that work? I know I see Stephen over there, but I had a question to you guys. Is that work?
I mean, we can certainly do that. I mean, I can only give you my personal view to say that what was in the paper, we think the words that are there at the minute can get you there, and obviously the board sort of last month agreed with us on that. But I mean, I think that obviously to make it clear, we can certainly work up amendments to make it clear.
What the committee is saying is that they, a large number of them are saying they don't think that's the an exclusive result.
Yeah.
So, Stephen?
If there is to be an amendment, can I make an appeal that first look at 28 and not at 9?
Yeah.
Because I think 9 is very clear. I think the classification and measurement does go with the impairment.
Absolutely.
And I think whether this long-term interest is fair value or cost, the same problem applies. So just sort of leave that as it is.
Exactly.
I do accept that there is an issue with 28 here, and I tend to agree with Philippe's analysis. So, but then, to my mind, this is already a problem. And I know expected loss increases the extent of that problem, but it is there at the moment.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm not sure why suddenly, other than it might be a slightly bigger number in 9, why suddenly this is now an issue. But I do accept it, but my appeal would be to look first at 28.
I suspect that part of the reason, Stephen, and we've asked ourselves this, asked this question about each other. 9 does raise increasing uncertainty about classification, whereas you could easily say this was held to maturity under 39 and pat yourself on the back and go home. You can't comfortably do that in 9, as Sandy's injection, I think, properly said. Add on to that the expected loss model, and it just raises the profile. But it, you're right, it was there. It's just bigger or more noticeable now.
And I suppose only to add that I think that what Steve said is reflecting some of my views, and even maybe so. Again, I agree with what you said, Wayne. It's just I'm not sure if what we can do if we decide we want to tackle what are in this long-term interest bucket and how do we think you apply classification and measurement and impairment under IFRS 9 to these particular instruments. That just seems, if we're suggesting that's what we need to do, that sounds like a bigger thing at least, or potentially quite a big thing compared to what we seem to be asked, which was navigating through.
I wasn't suggesting you had to answer all. But I think you have to compile the list. And then if you're not going to answer them, you need to tell people. Just say, this isn't, we ain't going to go there. I think a lot of what I heard was people saying, well, but what if, what if, what if? And you can knock them off and say, we're not going to do it. But I think the old people that tell them that that's not what you're going to do, or that's what you're not going to do, whatever the syntax. Okay. So we'll bring this one back.